frumpy and get fat, you know? I would never want your little actress's peach butt to turn into a big, giant writer's watermelon butt. Duly noted. Me writing makes Mom unhappy. Me acting makes Mom happy. I pick up the pages from the food table and tuck them back under my arm. As an afterthought, Mom asks what the screenplay is about. It's the story of a 10-year-old boy and his best friend as they try and pair their single parents together. Hmm, Mom says with a long look out the window. They already did that in The Parent Trap. I wake up at 8 a.m. on my Costco mat. My bunk bed is now overwrought with stuff, so I'm back to sleeping on the mat. I'm wearing my Revlon Runwalk 2002 tee. I like the design. It's got a lot of purple in it, which I'm into right now. I can't let Mom know I'm into purple, since Mom prefers pink. She would be heartbroken if I suddenly announced that I've switched my favorite color to one that isn't also hers. It is an honor that Mom cares about me so much that something like me having my own favorite color would devastate her. True love. Last year's Revlon Runwalk tee was mostly silver, and the year before that, it was mostly blue. I know about all the Runwalk tee colors for the past 7 years because that's how long my family has been attending the annual Runwalk. We started attending the Revlon Runwalks after Mom went into remission for her stage 4 metastatic ductal carcinoma, a term I am well acquainted with because, in addition to our weekly VHS viewing, Mom often has me recite it to casting directors. Everyone loves the story of somebody overcoming adversity. If you mention my ductal carcinoma, you'll get the sympathy vote. Mom's cancer rarely seems to come up organically on my auditions for The Suite Life of Zack and Cody and The King of Queens, but on shows like ER, I can wedge it in a little more naturally, especially if there's a character in the episode who has cancer. You know, my mom had stage 4 ductal carcinoma, so I really relate to the material. Mom always says that we go to the Revlon Runwalks to support women with breast cancer, which is so noble of her. Dustin once said under his breath that he thought Mom went more for the free cancer merch than the cause itself. But Dustin is a troublemaker and also Mom's least favorite child, which she even told him directly, so obviously Dustin doesn't know the first thing about Mom or her intentions. I'm rocking my oversized cancer tee and planning what poem I'll write for Mom this weekend. Since Mom's not a fan of me writing screenplays, I've taken an indefinite hiatus from those, but she's very supportive of me writing quick little poems about how much I love her, so I keep up with writing this way now. I'm trying to figure out what to rhyme with the word mommy when I realize my chest is kinda sore. More specifically, the nipple area of the right side of my chest. I reach my hand up to touch the sore area, and there I feel it. A lump. Terror immediately fills my body. This can't be happening. First Mom and now me. The room starts spinning. I weigh my options. I can go wake Mom to tell her now, but that seems burdensome. Or I can let her sleep until 11 a.m. when I usually wake her up with her morning cup of tea. I'd wake up earlier if I wasn't up so late stressing about money, Mom always says. Maybe if your father got a job that paid the bills for once so I wouldn't have to depend on a child. I don't know which to pick, so I do what any sensible, cancer-ridden tween deciding when to tell their mom does. I eeny, meeny, miny, mo it. Oh, sweetie. Mom half laughs as she runs her fingers back and forth along my puffy, lumped nipple on the right and then over my smooth, flat nipple on the left to compare. That's not cancer. Then what is it? You're just getting boobies. Oh, no. The only thing worse than a cancer diagnosis is a growing up diagnosis. I am horrified of growing up. First, I'm small for my age, which is a benefit in showbiz because I can book roles for characters younger than me. I can work longer hours on set and have to take fewer breaks by law. Logistics aside, I'm more cooperative and can take direction better than those 7-year-old scumbags. Mom is constantly reminding me how good it is that I look so young for my age. You'll book more, baby. You'll book a lot more. If I start to grow up, Mom won't love me as much. She often weeps and holds me really tight and says she just wants me to stay small and young. It breaks my heart when she does this. I wish I could stop time. I wish I could stay a child. I feel guilty that I can't. I feel guilty with every inch I grow. I feel guilty whenever we see one of my aunts or uncles and they comment on how much I'm growing up. I can see Mom's eyebrow twitch whenever they say that. I can see how much it pains her. I'm determined to not grow up. I'll do anything to stop it from happening. Well, is there anything I could do to stop the boobies from coming in? I ask Mom nervously. Mom breaks into a laugh exhale, the kind where her eyes wrinkle up. I know this expression well, the way I know all of Mom's expressions well. I have learned them inside and out so that I can behave accordingly at all times. No one else in the family seems to understand Mom's emotions. Everyone else walks around clueless, never knowing which Mom they're gonna get. But I always know. I've spent my whole life studying her so that I can always know. Because I always want to do whatever I can in any given moment to keep or make Mom happy. I know the difference between Mom being irritated and outraged. I know the difference between when she's upset at Dad or when she's upset at Grandma. Clenched jaw means Dad, tight eyebrow means Grandma. I know the difference between when she's a little happy, kisses me on the forehead, and a lot happy, sings Phil Collins. And right now, in this moment, where she laugh exhales and her eyes wrinkle up, I know that she's not only a lot happy, but a special, particular kind of happy. Mom is grateful happy. This is my favorite way to see her, because I am directly the source of it. I've seen Mom be grateful happy when I book roles and when I side with her when she's in the middle of an argument with anyone else in the house. Mom is grateful happy when she feels seen, valued, and nurtured. What can I do to stop the boobies from coming? I repeat, leaning further into my question now that I know it satisfies Mommy so much. Mom looks down, the way she does when she's about to tell me a secret, like the time she told me Grandma has false teeth or the time she said she finds Dad boring. I know something juicy is coming, something special, something just the two of us will know. Something that will cement and validate our wonderful best friendship the way only secrets can. Well, sweetheart, if you really want to know how to stay small, there's this secret thing you can do. It's called calorie restriction. I take to calorie restriction quickly, and I'm quite good at it. I'm desperate to impress Mom. She's a great teacher because she's been calorie restricting for so long, she tells me. Once when I was falling asleep as a child, I heard my mom and dad talking in the other room. They said my brother could eat anything and his metabolism would work it right off, but that anything I ate turned to fat. Those words got to me, Nat. They really did. I've been restricting ever since. Now that I think about it, it does make sense to me that Mom's been restricting. She only has hot tea every morning for breakfast, nothing in it, and a plate of steamed vegetables every night for dinner, nothing on them. I rarely see her eat lunch, and if she does, it's a salad with no dressing or half of a chocolate chip chewy granola bar. I'm in good hands. I start shrinking by the week as Mom and I team up to count our calories every night and plan our meals for the next day. We're keeping me on a 1,000-calorie diet, but I have the smart idea that if I only eat half my food, I'll only be receiving half the calories, which means that I will be shrinking twice as fast. I proudly show my half-eaten portions to Mom after every meal. She beams. Each Sunday, she weighs me and measures my thighs with a measuring tape. After a few weeks of our routine, she provides me with a stack of diet books that I finish quickly. I learn the value of eating water-dense fruits and vegetables like jicama and watermelon. I learn how helpful cayenne and chili peppers are for increasing your metabolism. I learn that coffee is an appetite suppressant, so I start drinking decaf, black, alongside Mom. Drinking coffee in any form is technically against the church's rules. "Well, it's decaf, so I'm sure God would make an exception," Mom says, and I nod like I agree, even though I'm pretty sure the God I've learned about doesn't make exceptions. The thinner I get, the stricter I get with what I'll ingest, because it seems like my body is trying to hold on to whatever I eat. I notice that most foods add a little body weight to me, 4/10 of a pound or so. I know this because I weigh myself 5 times a day. 5 is my lucky number, so this amount of daily weigh-in seems appropriate. I also want to make sure that I'm staying on top of every single shift in my body so that I can make proper adjustments and be on track for my weekly weighing session with Mom. My favorite foods are sugar-free popsicles, applesauce, and unsweetened iced tea, because these are the foods that don't seem to add weight to me. Popsicles and applesauce add nothing, and iced tea is peed right out. These are stress-free foods for me, safe foods, comfort foods. Whoever said mac and cheese and fried chicken were comfort foods was out of their mind. These are the real comfort foods. Mommy and I continue our mission, and I am thrilled. Every day feels to me like the montage of the twins in The Parent Trap, where Mom and I give each other Eskimo kisses and do silly hand jives in between our weekly weigh-ins and daily calorie counts. I watched the film after Mom suggested my screenplay Henry Road was a ripoff. She was right. Calorie restriction has brought me and Mom closer than we already were, which is really saying something because we were already so close. Calorie restriction is wonderful. We're about 6 months into our calorie restricting plan, and you can really see the difference. I'm down 3 sizes, and I'm now wearing a kid's size 7 slim. The Holy Spirit tells me to touch the word slim on my clothing tags 5 times every day because that ritual, along with my restriction, will keep me small. Thanks, Holy Spirit. Overall, things are going well, but today is an exception. Today, I am anxious because I'm sitting in the waiting room at my doctor's office waiting to be called back, and waiting to be called back means waiting to be weighed. And I'm terrified of being weighed on a scale that isn't my own. What if the numbers are off? What if I weigh more on this one? Mom seems to sense that I'm nervous, so she holds my hands while we wait, and wait, and wait. Until finally, "McCurdy, Jeanette," the doctor's assistant calls out. My heart starts pounding so intensely, I'm sure everyone in the room can hear it. My face feels hot. Time blurs while I walk through the waiting room door and into the hallway. Mom starts taking off my corduroy Children's Place jacket, knowing it adds extra weight. We're in this together. The nurse tells me I can leave my shoes on, but Mom tells me to take them off, always looking out. I kick off my shoes and step on the scale. Mom and I lock eyes. 61 pounds, the nurse says as she scribbles on her clipboard paper. As I hear the words come out of her mouth, they feel morphed and warped. I am crushed. The scale at home said 59. I immediately try to read Mom's expression. It's even, which means disappointment. I am even more crushed. We are escorted to room 5, my lucky number not seeming so lucky in this moment. I step up the little stepping stool and sit on the teddy bear paper on the patient's table. It's rough and pokey. The assistant asks a few more questions, then closes the door behind her. I open my mouth to say something, but Mom speaks before I can. We'll talk about it later. A few minutes pass, and Dr. Tran comes in. I'm disappointed it's Dr. Tran instead of Dr. Pellman, because Mom seems in a much better mood when it's Dr. Pellman. If it wasn't against the gospel, I'd think Mom has a crush on him, but I know better because lust is a sin and Mom would never engage in a sin. Dr. Tran keeps her eyes on her clipboard.
Debbie, could I speak with you privately for a minute?
Mom steps outside with Dr. Tran. The doors are thin enough and Mom talks loud enough that I can completely hear them.
So, I wanted to speak with you about Jeanette's weight, Dr. Tran starts. It's significantly lower than what's normal for her age.
Huh, Mom says, sounding a little anxious. She's eating normally. I haven't noticed any changes. That's not true. Mom has noticed the changes because she's the one who wanted the changes in the first place.
Well, Dr. Tran takes a big breath in. Sometimes when young girls have anorexia, they're very secretive about their food habits.
This is the first time I've heard the word anorexia. It sounds like a dinosaur. Dr. Tran continues on.
I suggest you keep a close eye on Jeanette's eating behaviors.
Oh, I will, Dr. Tran. I certainly will, Mom assures her. I'm confused. Mom already keeps an eye on my eating behaviors. She's as involved in them as I am, if not more so. Mom not only knows everything about how and what I eat, but she encourages and supports my habits. What's going on? What does this even mean?
A few months later, I hear the word anorexia again in the parking lot of my dance studio after class. I'm on the bench out front, waiting for Mom to arrive while I learn some sides for an audition to play Val Kilmer's daughter in an upcoming movie. Mom's always 20 to 45 minutes late picking me up, which makes sense because she's so busy with other things, like calling bill collectors to ask for holds and stopping by the Westminster Mall to pick up Hallmark thank you cards for every casting director I've read for in the past 6 months. They might not remember your read, but they'll remember a thank you card with pretty cursive writing on the front. I notice Angelica Gutierrez's mom has been loitering near her minivan, even though Angelica's last class was the same last class as mine, and the Gutierrez's usually leave right on time. Then I see Mom's copper Ford Windstar minivan make the left turn onto the street of the studio and pull into the parking lot. I grab my dance bag and start to head to the car, but Mrs. Gutierrez beats me to it. She approaches Mom's passenger window and asks her to roll it down.
Hi, Deb. I just wanted to talk to you real quick about Jeanette. I notice she's losing a lot of weight. It seems like she might have anorexia. I wanted to see if you're working on getting her help. Another girl in class struggled with it, and her mom gave me the name of a specialist.
Let's talk about this some other time.
Mom interrupts Mrs. Gutierrez in the way that tells me some other time is never going to come. I pull open the car door and jump in, and with that, we're on our way home.
Mom?
I ask once we're stopped at a red light.
Yeah, sweetheart?
What's anorexia?
Oh, don't worry about it, Angel. People are just being dramatic.
The light turns green. She steps on the gas.
Did you learn your lines?
Yeah.
Great. You've got a good shot at this one, Ned. I can feel it. Val's blonde, you're a shoo-in.
Uh-huh.
An absolute shoo-in.
I look out the window, then go back to learning my lines. I'm excited for the sugar-free popsicle I'll have when I get home. Today is the day I enter Beehives, the church's program for girls 12 to 13 years old. Upon entering the program, you're assigned a role, and the role I've just been assigned is assistant secretary, a position that doesn't even exist.
But Madison's already secretary, I tell Sister Smith, my teacher, so what am I supposed to do?
Well, you can help her out. I look down at my fingernails to hide my disappointment. Michaela Lindsay leans over to talk to me.
The girls who get the good positions are the ones who are for sure always going to be active.
I hate Michaela. I know she was adopted and I should feel bad for her and all that, but I don't. I just plain hate her. She continues on.
They gave you your position because they think you'll probably eventually become inactive.
Inactive is all but a cuss word in the Mormon Church. Active members are those who regularly attend service. Inactive ones are those who have fallen off or stopped attending even though they're still on the church's records. Whenever an inactive member is brought up in a conversation in church, the member's name is said with a nose scrunch and a whispery tone like it's something shameful and pathetic.
We're not going to go inactive.
We'll see,
Michaela shrugs. Even though I hate Michaela and I desperately want her to be wrong, I fear that she might be right. If I really think about it, there are already a few signs. For as far back as I can remember, my family has never fit the bill of first-rate Mormons. In every Latter-day Saints ward,
There are the kinds of Mormons who have perfect attendance in seminary and are off book for their third Nephi verses. The kinds of Mormons who are trusted to bring the chicken pot pie to the potluck. Those clearly capable of that level of responsibility. These are the first-rate Mormons. And then there are the kinds of Mormons who skimp on tithing and always show up 20 minutes late to service. The just go ahead and bring the salad kinds of Mormons. Those who can't be trusted with any more responsibility than some bagged iceberg lettuce with the stale croutons already mixed in. These are the second-rate Mormons. We, the McCurdys, are second-rate Mormons. I've known this for a while. There's a certain pity that first-rates view second-rates with, and I've sensed that pity in side eyes from Sister Huffmeyer and Sister Meeks, who are both first-rates. Everybody knows that second-rates are much more likely than first-rates to go inactive, but still, I didn't think our fate was by any means sealed. I was sure we could reverse our second-rate status with some Mormon milestone, like Marcus serving a mission or us never skipping service. But now that Michaela's brought it up and I'm thinking it through, I'm coming to terms with the fact that maybe those Mormon milestones won't happen after all. Marcus has been old enough to go on his mission for several years, but he hasn't gone. And even though there's no age restriction for going on one, men are 70% less likely to go if they don't go within that first year that they're able, according to the Mormon magazine Ensign, the only magazine besides Women's World that's in Mom's regular rotation. Mom says it's Marcus's girlfriend Elizabeth's fault, and that she's got the devil in her, but I'm not so sure. Elizabeth seems fine to me. We've also started skipping service some weeks, usually around the release of episodes of shows that I've had guest star roles on. It first started after Law & Order SVU, when Sister Salazar asked Mom if she thought it was in line with the gospel for me to be portraying a 9-year-old rape victim. Mom had a brilliant defense about how she thinks the value of a TV starlet being Mormon outweighs the roles that that starlet plays. Sister Salazar let it go for a while, until I was in an episode of a show where I played a child who murders another child. Ever since then, every time an episode of a show I'm on airs, we skip a week or two of church to avoid the judgers, as Mom says. Regardless of the reasoning, we're skipping service, and skipping service is the opposite of a Mormon milestone required to turn us into first-rates. Mom, I ask when we're back at home, folding laundry together.
Yes, sweetheart?
Are we going to become inactive Mormons?
Of course not. Why would you even ask that, Nett?
Michaela said the reason I got assigned assistant secretary is because they think we'll probably go inactive.
Oh, please, what does Michaela Lindsay know? She's adopted. Nett, shower time!
Mom shouts from another room. My whole body freezes. Oh no, not shower time. I've dreaded showers for a while, 5 years or so. Whenever it was that I started to feel uncomfortable that Mom still showers me. She doesn't mean to make me uncomfortable, I don't think. She says she has to shower me because I wouldn't know how to shampoo and condition my own hair. She says maybe if it wasn't so long or such a specific texture that she wouldn't have to, but because it is those things, and since she was a professional hairstylist, it just makes sense for her to do it. Mom showers me with Scotty sometimes. He's almost 16 at this point. I get really embarrassed when she showers us together. I can tell he does too. We usually just look away from each other, and Scott distracts himself by drawing Pokemon in the fogged glass. He does a pretty good Charizard. When she showers us together, Mom says it's because she's got too much to do. Scott asked if he could shower himself once. Mom sobbed and said she didn't want him to grow up, so we never asked again after that. Whether or not Scott's there with me, Mom gives me a breast and front butt exam, which is what she calls my private parts. She says she wants to make sure I don't have any mysterious lumps or bumps because those could be cancer. I say okay because I definitely don't want cancer, and since Mom's had it and all, she would know if I do. I usually just try and think of Disneyland when Mom's doing the exams. I think of the next time Grandpa will sign us in. I think of the parade and the fireworks and the characters all happy and everything. By the time the exams are done, a huge wave of relief washes over my whole body, and I usually realize that's the first time I've felt my body since the exam started. It's weird. When the exams are happening, I feel like I'm outside of myself. Like my body is a shell I'm disconnected from, and I'm living entirely in my thoughts. My Main Street, Fantasyland, Mr. Toad's Wild Ride thoughts. Actually, I usually don't think of Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, because as much as people love it, I think that ride's mediocre.
Nett?
Mom calls out again. My body's still frozen. I swallow and force a response up my throat.
I'm ready.
She's showering me alone tonight. I know because I have an audition for House tomorrow, and I've noticed this pattern that whenever I have an audition, Mom showers me alone. I think it's because she wants to make sure she gets the shampooing and conditioning just right so that my hair will look perfectly glossy for the casting director. Mom says this business is shallow and that glossy hair can be the difference between getting a callback or not. My breathing is shaky as I set down my schoolwork and get up off the couch. My hands are clammy. I try and focus on the relief I'll feel as soon as the exams are done and I know the shower is just about over. I try and focus on that lightness, that feeling that everything's better and rosier for the rest of the night. I'm trying. I get to the bathroom. Mom won't let me turn on the faucet because she says it's tricky to twist the handles and get the right temperature, so I wait for her. While I wait, I take off my pants, then my underwear, then my shirt. I step into the shower and hear the drip of the leaking faucet. I study the mold on it. It's white and blue and crusty. I hear Mom's footsteps as she approaches the bathroom. I'm off to Fantasyland. I'm sitting in the back seat of the Ford Windstar. We're driving to the art supply warehouse to visit Dustin on his shift. Dustin seems to hate this, but Mom loves it. I think she enjoys knowing people who work at the place she's visiting. I think it makes her feel like a VIP. Her posture and energy shift completely whenever she walks into Best Buy to visit Marcus or the ticket stand at Disneyland to visit Grandpa. She gets this aura like she owns the place. I love seeing Mom so confident. As we drive over, Mom's on the phone with the bill collector, asking for an extension, when she turns to me excitedly.
Susan's calling!
I know why Susan's calling. Yesterday, I screen-tested for a show called iCarly, a new Nickelodeon show about young teenagers who create a web show together. And next week, I'm supposed to screen-test for a show called Californication, a new Showtime show about a man who mistreats women. By the time you get to the screen test for a TV show, they already have the contracts all written up, and apparently it's good when you're testing for more than one show at the same time, because your manager can use that as leverage to get you the best deal possible. Mom loves saying the word leverage on calls with Susan. She says it makes her sound in the know. There's also this weird rule that whichever show tests you first gets first choice on whether to pick you or not. They get a designated amount of time to decide if they for sure want you, then if they haven't decided by that point, the other network gets first choice. I had my screen test for iCarly yesterday, so they have first choice as to whether they want me. Susan calling right now means Nickelodeon has made up their mind. As excited as Mom is to talk to Susan, she finishes up with the bill collector first, like she always does. I'm not going to drop the call after I've been waiting on hold for an hour. Mom weeps her way through an extension, but by the time she hangs up with Brandon at Sprint PCS, her tears are dry. While she dials Susan, she thrusts her hand back behind her and toward me. I'm sitting in my booster seat. I'm 14 and still in the booster. I have to lunge forward as far as I can to grip her hand, and since the seat belt is pulled through the booster seat, the length of the belt is shortened so it locks sooner. The second I lean forward to grab Mom's hand, the belt makes the clicking sound of it locking. I'm trying to reach her hand, but I can't. Click, click, click. Hi, can I speak with Susan? It's Debbie McCurdy. Click, click. Mom's hand wags around, trying to find mine. Our fingers almost graze. Okay, yeah, I think I can figure out how to put it on speaker. Mom presses buttons aimlessly on her phone until something works, and Susan's voice starts blaring from the speakerphone. She booked iCarly! She booked iCarly! Mom's hand flies forward to accompany her woohoo in what can only be described as a questionable fist pump. Whatever it is, it takes her hand away from mine, and my whole body feels that. But just for a second. Because then it hits me. I've booked my first series regular role. Mom pulls into the art supply warehouse parking lot while we both scream at the top of our lungs. She pulls into a reserved-for-handicapped space. She's thrilled she has a handicapped card since her diverticulitis diagnosis. I unbuckle my seatbelt as quickly as I can. I jump into Mom's arms. She squeezes me. I'm elated. Everything's gonna be different now. Everything's gonna be better. Mom will finally be happy. Her dream has come true.
Ooh, a fruit basket!
Mom unwinds the twist tie and starts peeling off the cellophane wrapping.
Pineapple's really high in sugar, but you can have some of this cantaloupe and honeydew.
Okay. Mom yanks two cantaloupe skewers out of the basket. Just as she's about to pass mine to me, she has a second thought and places it back.
We can split one, she says.
We start chewing on our flower-shaped cantaloupe pieces as we look around at the other baskets on my dressing room table. There's a basket of teas from Coast to Coast, an at-home spa basket from Susan, and a meat and cheese basket from Nickelodeon.
We can take that one home for Grandpa and the boys, Mom tells me.
This is the first difference I notice about being a series regular. You get a lot of baskets. I never got one basket in all my years as a guest star, although when I did my guest spot on Karen Sisko, Robert Forster did give me a silver pen with my name engraved on it, and he gave Mom a silver shoehorn. What a guy. Today is our first day back to work after being officially picked up for a first season order. After you shoot the pilot of a TV show, the network executives watch all the pilots and pick about a third of them to actually get made into a series. We were part of the lucky third, and even cooler than that, we got the highest episode order of all the picked-up shows. Most of them got 10 or 13 episode pickups. We got 20. Mom says this is probably because of my outstanding performance as Sam Puckett, a zinger-slinging, rough-around-the-edges tomboy with a heart of gold who, ironically, compared to my experience with it, loves food.
You ready to run lines, Angel? Mom asks.
Sure, I say, even though I'm never ready. I still get nervous to practice lines with Mom. I thought my being cast as a series regular might help her lighten up a bit, but it hasn't. She's still so critical. It's stressful. I take a deep breath in to get ready for my first line when there's a loud knock at my dressing room door.
Answer it!
Mom tells me as she slaps her thigh, exasperated to be interrupted the second before we started. I pull open the purple door, and on the carpet in front of me is yet another basket. This one's filled with movie theater snacks, Milk Duds and Twizzlers, and a few packets of popcorn. In the middle of the basket is a $100 gift card to Arclight, the fanciest movie theater I've ever seen, the one just up the street from Nickelodeon Studios where we shoot the show. Mom and I almost saw a movie at Arclight the week that we shot the pilot, but Mom said there was no chance in hell she was paying $13.75 for a movie ticket.
I don't care how surrounded their sound is.
This gift card is the highest dollar amount gift card I've ever seen. I almost can't believe it.
It's from Miranda, I tell Mom, shocked. $100 to Arclight.
Miranda is my co-star on iCarly. She plays the titular role of Carly Shay, a sweet, feminine teenage girl who, with her best friends Sam and Freddie, played by my other co-star Nathan, starts a web series. Mom says they didn't flesh out Miranda's character very well.
Poor thing gets all the exposition. She's a pretty girl, but it's a shame her character has no personality.
I look back down at the basket. I'm really surprised that another child actor would be so nice to me. Usually there's such a sense of competition. This gesture is the opposite of that. I'm touched. I reach into the basket.
You're not getting anywhere near those Milk Duds, but that's very nice of her. Now let's practice your lines.
What about this? Mom asks as she holds up a TY plush panda bear. We're in Hallmark greeting cards at the Westminster Mall. Since Miranda got a gift for me to celebrate the start of the season, we're picking one out for her, too. Mom wags the panda around.
It's a cute little panda. Plus it rhymes with her name, Miranda. Panda. Cute, right?
Yeah, it's really cute. Maybe we could just keep looking around to make sure that's the absolute best gift.
Well, I think this with the fuzzy journal and we're good, right?
Mom asks.
Sure, right.
I swallow. We're not good. Miranda got me a very expensive gift card to a very fancy movie theater. That is a cool gift. A TY stuffed animal and a fuzzy journal is not a cool gift. I used to think these were cool gifts up until a few months ago. Up until a few months ago, I thought my rainbow bell bottoms from the children's place and my quiz books from Limited 2 were cool. But since meeting Miranda, my cool radar has shifted. The first time I met her was at my screen test for iCarly. She was leaning against a wall, sipping Coke from a glass bottle and texting on her sidekick. Whoa. Coke and a sidekick. This girl knows what's up.
We talked briefly at the screen test, but not much more than introductions because we were rushed into the room to do our scenes together for the long table of executives.
We didn't talk a ton during the shooting of the pilot either. I felt shy and it seemed to me like she did too. We ran our lines between takes and said an enthusiastic, "Bye, see you tomorrow," at the end of each day, but there wasn't much else in between. I studied her from afar, though. Miranda seemed to have an independence I didn't have, and it fascinated me. She walked alone to pick up food from a different nearby restaurant each day. Alone. What's that like? Then I'd always hear when she came walking back into the studio because she'd be playing Gwen Stefani or Avril Lavigne from her sidekick. I knew of these artists, but Mom didn't allow me to listen to them because she said their music might make me want to do bad things. On set, Miranda said cuss words like shit and ass, and she took the Lord's name in vain at least 50 times a day. Mom warned me not to get too close to Miranda because she doesn't believe in God. Nathan is okay for me to get close to, Mom says, because he does. Southern Baptists are no Mormons, but at least we've got Jesus in common. Even though Mom said not to get close to Miranda, I really wanted to. I wanted some of her coolness to rub off on me. And she seemed nice, too, which is hard to be if you're cool. I had my fingers crossed that somehow, despite our mutual shyness, a friendship between us would develop. But then, unfortunately, it didn't seem likely. Each day that passed where we didn't exchange phone numbers, I felt like we were getting further away from a potential friendship. Until, on the last day of shooting the pilot, just as Miranda was leaving set, she turned back and said, "Hey, Jeanette, do you have aim?" "Not really," I said, thinking she was talking about throwing things. I've never had good aim.
"You don't have AOL Instant Messenger?"
She seemed shocked.
"Oh, aim," I said, hoping that I sounded convincing, like I knew what it was even though I still didn't. "Yeah, I have it."
"Cool. It had me."
"Cool."
And I felt it. As soon as I got home that day, I had Marcus sign me up for an account. Over AIM, our friendship blossomed. Miranda and I spent hours talking every day on it. Sometimes if Mom walked past and asked me what I was doing, I'd tell her I was talking to Miranda, but most of the time I'd shrink the AIM text bubble, lie, and say I was doing schoolwork. She didn't question me. She'd leave the room and then I'd pull the text bubble back up and start laughing. Even though in person Miranda seemed shy and quiet, she had a distinct and hilarious personality through her written words. So many of the things she said made me laugh. Her way of observing things, people, habits, human nature. I loved her, and I was so excited we were becoming friends. But now Mom's lame gifts were going to ruin it. Back at work, I set the gift bag down and knocked 3 times on Miranda's door, Then I rushed back to my dressing room. I didn't want to see her reaction when she opened the stuffed animal and fuzzy journal. I was too embarrassed. Miranda doesn't mention the gifts at first, not for almost our entire workday. I'm scared our friendship may be over. But then as we're walking toward the parking lot with our moms at the end of the day, she turns to me and, through nervous laughter, says,
"Thanks for the stuffed animal. It's really cute."
"You're welcome."
"And the journal, too. I'm excited to get back to journaling."
"Awesome." She smiles at me. I can tell she's just being nice, but I appreciate the kindness.
"See you on AIM later,"
she says with a wave.
"Okay,"
I say excitedly, a little too excitedly. Even if she didn't like her panda and fuzzy journal, even if she was just being nice when she said thanks for them, she still wants to be friends. I'm so glad I have AIM. I'm standing behind the curtain in the dressing room of the soundstage that we shoot the show on. My arms are folded across my body. My foot is tapping anxiously. I don't want to come out from behind the curtain.
"Come on out, Nat. They'll just get one picture and then you'll be good to go."
"Okay." I step out. I feel my cheeks blush with embarrassment. I hate this feeling, the feeling of so much of my body being exposed. It feels sexual to me. I'm ashamed.
"You look great,"
the wardrobe assistant who's always sewing yell says from across the room without looking up from her sewing machine. I worry that great means sexual. I fold my arms across my body to try and cover it up more. I hunch my shoulders over like a little cave to protect me. I don't want to look sexual. I want to look like a child.
"I'll definitely push for the one piece, but thank you for humoring me and trying on the bikini,"
the head of wardrobe says while she pulls her hair up into a bun and pins it into place with chopsticks. "Sure," I say, unable to look at her, or at Mom, who sits on the stairs in the opposite corner of the room.
"Set your arms down, Angel. Try and look more comfortable,"
Mom tells me. I set them down. I'm no more comfortable.
"Shoulders back,"
Mom does the gesture herself to lead by example. I pull my shoulders back the way she loves and I hate. I don't like puffing out my chest. I'm not proud of my chest and the little nipple buds on it, and the only reason for puffing out something is if you're proud of it. I hate this. I want to be done with this wardrobe fitting. I ask if I could please just try on one pieces with board shorts, the way that I feel most comfortable in a bathing suit, being covered up. But our wardrobe designer said that the creator explicitly asked for bikinis, and so she had to at least have me try on one or two of them so he had the option.
"Okay, take a few steps toward me so I can get a picture,"
our wardrobe designer tells me as she pulls her Polaroid camera up to her eyes. I take a few steps forward. She snaps the photo.
"What do you say? Want to try on the last bikini?"
she asks me like she's tempting me. It confuses me when people throw a spin on the delivery of something to overcompensate for the fact that the thing they're delivering is unpleasant.
Can I not? I ask. Can I leave it at the one I just tried?
"Well, he wants options," the wardrobe designer says, pulling an over-exaggerated you-know-him kind of expression that doesn't resonate. Because I don't know him. Not really. I've only met him a few times. He seems effusive and boisterous to me, but Mom says she's heard rumblings from crew members that he's got a hair-trigger temper and to be sure not to get on his bad side. I pick my nails.
"Come on, Nat, just one more," Mom urges me.
"Okay," I say. I try on the last bikini. It's blue with a green stripe around the edges of it. There are ties on the bottoms. I hate the way the ties trickle down my legs. I feel sick to my stomach. I look at myself in the dressing room mirror. I'm small. I know I'm small. But I worry that my body is fighting the smallness, that it's trying to develop, to grow. I feel like I'm barely hanging on to my childlike body and the innocence that comes with it. I'm terrified of being looked at like a sexual being. It's disgusting. I'm not that. I'm this. I'm a child. I step out of the dressing room. The wardrobe designer snaps my picture.
"You look great,"
the ever-sewing wardrobe assistant calls out again without looking up. 32. Our lips are touching. He's moving his mouth around a bit, but I can't move mine. I'm frozen. His eyes are closed, mine aren't. Mine are wide open, staring at him. It's so odd, staring at a person while your faces are touching. I don't like it. I can smell his hair gel.
"Move your head around a bit more, Jeanette," the creator yells from off camera.
Sometimes, even when the camera's rolling, producers or directors shout things off camera. So long as they're not overlapping a line of dialogue, the editor can just take out the yelling in post-production. I try to do as the creator tells me. I honestly try, but I can't bring myself to do it. My body is stiff, unflinching. My body is rejecting my mind. My mind is saying, who cares that this is your first kiss, that your first kiss is on camera? Get it over with. Do what you're told. My body is saying, no, I don't want this. I don't want my first kiss to be like this. I want my first kiss to be a real first kiss, not a kiss for a TV show. I disdain the part of me that's romantic. I'm embarrassed by it. Mom's been very clear about how boys are a waste of time and will only disappoint me, and how I should just focus on my career, which I get. So I try to force it away. But as much as I try to force it away, that romantic part of me is there. And it's been there for a while. I wonder about boys sometimes. What it would be like to love one. I wonder if one will ever love me. I fantasize about watching the Disneyland fireworks together, about holding hands, about resting my head on his chest, about laughing together. I used to wonder about kissing. How it would work. It's a thing you can't practice ahead of time. It just happens at some point. Do you just go with it? Is it difficult? What do lips taste like? These are all questions that now, in this moment, I have the answers to. You try to just go with it, and if you're Nathan, my co-star, it seems like you can. But if you're me, you can't. If you're me, you're just thinking about every single little thing that's happening, and your mind is racing, and you can't wait for it to be over with. It is difficult. Lips taste like Blistex chapstick. I start to wonder if all this would be different if I loved the person. Maybe that's the secret ingredient, the missing piece. Maybe if I were kissing somebody I loved, it would be magical and incredible and not this terrifying rush of anxiety. Cut! The creator yells off camera, his mouth full of something. I hear his footsteps as he pads over to us, carrying a paper plate piled with cheese slices and unwrapped mini candy bars. The crew parts like the Red Sea, letting the creator pass by them and walk up to us. The creator looks me right in the eye but doesn't say anything for 4 or 5 seconds. I almost start to laugh, thinking he might be messing with me for fun like he does sometimes. But then I recognize that there is a deep anger in him. This is no time for laughter. Finally, he speaks. Jeanette. More. Head. Movement. He turns and walks away. Why aren't we rolling? He shouts. The cameras roll. We start the scene. I don't even know the words coming out of my mouth, but I trust that they must be the words that were written on the page because nobody's stopping me and saying I'm speaking gibberish. It's an out-of-body experience, doing the scene leading up to the kiss. My heart is pounding. My hands are clammy. Here it comes, here it comes, here it comes. We lean in. Our lips touch. Lips feel nasty. They're like little gross fleshy piles of flesh. It's disgusting to be a person. Shoot, I'm supposed to move my head. I start moving it. Back and forth. Back and forth. I sway it around. It doesn't feel natural, so I'm sure it doesn't look natural. Nathan, as his character Freddy, finally breaks away. Cut! The creator shouts. I can tell by his tone that he isn't happy. He looks to the assistant director. Do we have time for another? Not really, sir. We've got to head to scene J if we're going to wrap up on time. Fine, he says angrily. That was not ideal, but fine, we'll move on. I'll be at Crafty. The creator storms off, heading to Crafty for his chips or his bagel or his minestrone soup. I watch him go. I'm sad I didn't please him. Hey, we're done, Nathan says kindly, knowing how nervous I was to do my first on-screen kiss with him. Yeah, I say with a nervous half-laugh. We're done. Just like that, my first kiss is over with. And my second kiss, and my third kiss. And my fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh, technically, since we did 7 takes.
Make sure you smile a lot, with teeth. When you do your no-teeth smile, it looks kind of forlorn. Mom tells me as she changes lanes on the 405. We're on our way to a lunch meeting with the creator. I'm nervous because Mom says a lot is at stake. She thinks this could be an I'm thinking of giving you a spin-off lunch date, since it's very common for him to write spin-off shows for characters of his current shows. I've thought about telling Mom I think we might be disappointed if we put that expectation on it, but I haven't said a word. She does well when she has something in my life to look forward to.
And don't forget to act really interested in whatever he says, really engaged, Mom tells me. Try and make your eyes a little wider if you can. It'll help him pop.
I nod along.
One of us should bring up my cancer, too, to really get him on our side. I can take that if you'd like.
Sure.
Great, 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 great. Mom says excitedly.
We get to lunch right on time. The creator's already there, sunglasses on, even though he's indoors. He lifts them up when he sees us. He stands up from the booth, hugs Mom first, and then hugs me into a tight squeeze, picking me up off the ground.
McCurdy Curds, he says, finally setting me down as he repositions his sunglasses. My favorite little actress.
Mom beams. You know, I work with a lot of young actresses. A lot of them are pretty, some of them are funny, but none of them are as talented as you. Mom's face looks like it's going to rip if she smiles any bigger. I smile too, with my teeth, like Mom specified.
Thank you.
I mean it, the creator continues on, spooning some of the tuna tartare he already ordered onto his appetizer plate. You act circles around them. You could win an Oscar someday.
Thank you.
This is how conversations with the creator usually start. He'll heap the compliments on while undercutting other talent that he works with. I appreciate the compliments. The creator's approval means a lot to me. He's the reason I'm a series regular on a television show. He's the reason my family and I don't have to worry about money anymore. But at the same time, I wonder if he's trying to pit me and his other talent against one another. I wonder if he says the same sorts of things to each of his talent so that we each stay in line and think we're in his good favor, I wonder this because now that we've worked on an entire season of television together, I've had plenty of time to get familiar with the creator's ways, to understand him. I feel like the creator has two distinct sides. One is generous and over-the-top complimentary. He can make anyone feel like the most important person in the world. I've seen him do this when he made the entire crew give our production designer a 5-minute standing ovation for the jail set he built in 2 days. Or when he gave a speech thanking our stunt coordinator. The coordinator cried with gratitude. The creator knows how to make someone feel important. The other side is mean-spirited, controlling, and terrifying. The creator can tear you down and humiliate you. I've seen him do this when he fired a 6-year-old on the spot for messing up a few lines on a rehearsal day. And when a boom operator accidentally dropped the boom into a shot and the creator stomped over to him and screamed in his face that he was responsible for ruining a magical take and he hoped that he would regret it for the rest of his life. I've seen the creator make grown men and women cry with his insults and degradation. He'll call people idiots, buffoons, stupid, dumb, sloppy, careless, retarded, and spineless. The creator knows how to make someone feel worthless. That's why I've learned with time that as much as I want the compliments to mean something to me, I can't let them. Because tomorrow he might be screaming insults in my face that will hurt me just as much as the compliments raise me up. I feel that I always need to be on guard around him, catering to him emotionally. I feel similarly around the creator as I feel around Mom. On edge, desperate to please, terrified of stepping out of line. Put both of them together in the same room and I'm overwhelmed. The creator orders main courses for us to share. Something with lobster, a pasta with meat, and a flatbread. I know Mom won't approve of me eating any of these foods, but I know the creator will be offended if I don't eat them, and he will comment on me not trusting him or thinking he has bad taste, so I pick at the food as convincingly as I can, hoping the creator will believe I'm eating and Mom will know I'm not. So, the reason I invited you both to lunch, the creator starts. He takes a long sip of his old-fashioned while Mom watches him, eager for him to finish the sentence in the way she wants it to be finished. Well, first, the creator says, almost as if he's intentionally dragging out the tension as long as he possibly can. Let me ask you a question. How do you like being recognized, being famous? She loves it, Mom answers for me. Absolutely loves it. And the fans adore her, too. They almost always say she's their favorite character. I poke at my pasta. All right, good, the creator says, because you're going to have a lot more of it. Mom's breath gets rapid with anticipation. I want to give Jeanette her own show. Mom accidentally drops her fork with excitement. It clinks against the plate. I even have the name picked out. Just Bucket. Isn't that a fun name for your own show? Dan asks with a smirk. Yes, yes it is. It's a very fun name, Mom chimes in. It can't happen for a while because iCarly's doing too well, the creator says, trying to temper Mom's excitement. She nods along. We'll have to wait a couple years, the creator reiterates. But if you keep doing what you're doing and listen to me, take my advice and let me guide you, I promise you I'll give you your own show. Oh, thank you, Mom says, tears welling in her eyes. My baby deserves it. My baby deserves it. Mom looks over at me and nods, urging me to smile with teeth. So I do, even though I'm concerned. The creator was very clear that his offer had a contingent, me listening to him, taking his advice, and letting him guide me. And even though a part of me appreciates the creator, a part of me is scared of him, and the idea that I'll have to do everything he wants is intimidating to me. Why don't you seem happier? You're getting your own show, Mom says on our drive home. I am happy, I lie. Very happy. Good, Mom says as she glances at me in the rearview mirror. Because you should be. Everyone wants what you have. I've been on iCarly for almost 3 years now, and in some ways, things are easier. My friendship with Miranda has been a source of camaraderie and emotional support. I'm friends with the rest of the cast, too, but my connection with Miranda is different and special. We Skype on the weekends and see movies at Arclight after work. I now go there twice a week without batting an eye. Mom always joins. She'll lean over to me midway through the movie, her head bowing resignation. Their sound is very surrounded. More important than my friendship with Miranda, Mom's not as stressed about the two things she's typically most stressed about, bills and my body. Even though the consistency of my paychecks has helped bring Mom some financial comfort and stability, she makes her opinion of the size of those paychecks well known. They should be ashamed of the salary they give you. Compared to network TV, it's jelly beans, jelly beans, she tells me every day in my dressing room while she changes my clothes for me. And no residuals either with Nickelodeon, or should I say nickel and dime-elodeon. Despite her complaints, I know deep down she's grateful, because this is a big step up from where we were before. The house payments are made on time and in full, and she no longer has to call bill collectors and beg for extensions. She still monitors my lunches, but sometimes she lets me eat the food on set. My dinners are still mostly iceberg lettuce with dressing spray and ripped up pieces of low-calorie bologna, but she'll give me 2 Smart Ones cookies for dessert. And my breakfasts have totally transformed.
She makes me breakfast, which I never imagined would happen. She'll pour 2% milk on top of honeycomb cereal. 2%, not non-fat. And sure, honeycomb cereal is still one of the lowest calorie breakfast cereals per gram, as Mom says. 160 calories for 1 3/4 cups. But this is crazy. I've never seen her support eating like this. A part of me wonders if Mom is supporting my meals a bit more because Miranda and Nathan eat breakfast and lunch in our joint schoolroom, and it might look weird if I don't, or if I eat much less than them or something. But I don't ask her. I just let it happen. My body is shifting a bit. My nipple buds have become very tiny breasts, and it's getting harder to hide them with my undershirt pulled through underwear legs technique. My skin is breaking out a bit too, which is new and weird and embarrassing. This past year, I've started wearing makeup on set, and even on my off days. I used to hate makeup, but now I want to wear it, to hide behind it. I recently started shaving my legs, too. Well, Mom does it for me, because she still showers me even though I'm 16. I didn't even know shaving legs was a thing until I heard a co-star's mom making fun of my hairy legs to my co-star, and then she laughed in a way that has haunted me every time I've shaved my legs since. So now, even though Mom isn't as stressed about bills or my body, my legs are smooth and my nipples are past bud stage and my skin is red and bumpy in places, and all of this feels awkward to me. The show has progressively grown in popularity. Susan keeps throwing around terms like cultural phenomenon and global sensation. The more the show's exploded, the more my fame has too. I've been on countless red carpets for fancy events and award shows and movie premieres. I've done talk shows like Good Morning America and The Today Show and Craig Ferguson and Bonnie Hunt's new one. I can't go places anymore without being recognized. I no longer go to Disneyland, my favorite place, because last time I tried, I was walking down Main Street and so many people came up to me that they had to stop the Christmas fantasy parade midway through. Goofy looked pissed. The kind of fame I have now is causing me a level of stress that I did not know was possible. I know everybody wants it, and everybody tells me how lucky I am to have it, but I hate it. I feel constantly on edge whenever I leave the house to go anywhere. I'm worried that strangers will come up to me, and I get very anxious when interacting with strangers. They'll shout at me things like, "Sam, where's your fried chicken?" or "Can you hit me with your butter sock?" A butter sock is a prop my character frequently uses, and it's exactly what it sounds like. A sock filled with butter. My character carries it around to beat people up with. Whenever someone shouts at me about chicken or socks, I'll laugh like it's a good one even though it's not a good one. I've heard this good one thousands of times, and it was a bad one from the get-go, but it only morphs into a worse one with each time I hear it. I'm shocked by how many people think they're original and say the same thing. I'm so unimpressed by people, even irritated by them, at times even disgusted by them. I don't know exactly when this happened, but I know it's a relatively recent switch, and I know fame had something to do with it. I'm tired of people approaching me like they own me, like I owe them something. I didn't choose this life. Mom did. My anxiety causes me to be a people pleaser. My anxiety causes me to take the picture and sign my autograph and say it's a good one. But underneath that anxiety is a deep, unearthed combination of feelings that I fear to face. I fear that I'm bitter. I'm too young to be bitter, especially as a result of a life that people supposedly envy. And I fear that I resent my mother, the person I have lived for, my idol, my role model, my one true love. This complicated feeling crops up when I take a picture with a stranger and I see Mom standing off to the side, mirroring the smile she wants me to have. It happens when she tells the person taking the picture to get one more or two more just in case, when she knows how much I dislike this whole thing. It happens when she has me practice my autographs and tells me, "It's getting sloppy, little C, big C, URDY. They need to be able to read every letter." It happens when she pitches me on what slogan to write to accompany my autographs. "See you at the movies" is the current winner, and Lord knows why. I'm not even in movies, I'm on TV, and kids' TV at that, which, if anything, almost guarantees the fact that I will never be in any movies. The transition from child stardom to a legitimate career as an adult in the entertainment industry is a notoriously tough one, even for young actors blessed with roles in credible films with credible directors. But for kids who start out on kids' TV, it's a career death sentence. There's something about the one-dimensional, overly glossy image combined with the extent of the public recognition of that image that makes it nearly impossible to overcome. The second the child star tries to outgrow and break free from their image, they become bait for the media, highly publicized as rebellious, troubled, and tortured, when all they're trying to do is grow. Growing is wobbly and full of mistakes, especially as a teenager, mistakes that you certainly don't want to make in the public eye, let alone be known for the rest of your life. But that's what happens when you're a child star. Child stardom is a trap, a dead end, and I can see that even if Mommy can't. Fame has put a wedge between Mom and me that I didn't think was possible. She wanted this, and I wanted her to have it. I wanted her to be happy. But now that I have it, I realize that she's happy and I'm not. Her happiness came at the cost of mine. I feel robbed and exploited. Sometimes I look at her and I just hate her. And then I hate myself for feeling that. I tell myself I'm ungrateful. I'm worthless without her. She's everything to me. Then I swallow the feeling I wish I hadn't had, tell her, I love you so much, Nani Mommy, and I move on, pretending that it never happened. I've pretended for my job for so long, and for my mom for so long, and now I'm starting to think I'm pretending for myself, too. It's a Sunday morning, and everyone else in the house is asleep. I reheat the mug of Mom's favorite raspberry royale tea that I first made an hour ago and wake her with it.
Mommy, I say gently, here's your tea.
Mom half groans in her sleep while she twists onto her other side. I eye the clock nervously, debating whether or not to keep trying to wake her. This is the third time I've tried, and technically the latest possible time I could wake her without us being late.
Mommy, I say with a bit more urgency in my tone, we have to leave for church in 20 minutes or we won't make it in time.
Mom groans more aggressively.
Do you not want to go? I ask.
I'm too tired, Mom mutters. Then she swallows and the words come out a little clearer.
I've worked too hard lately. I'm too tired.
She burrows her face deeper into the pillow and her breathing gets heavy. I study her. I'm tired, too. I've worked hard lately, too. I actually think I worked a lot harder than Mom has, and then I feel guilty for thinking this. She does drive me to and from work, which has to be tiring, a part of me thinks. Yeah, but I do homework on the drive, plus memorize lines, then spend 10 hours on set rehearsing and performing and being on under bright lights and intense pressure while she sits up in my dressing room perusing Woman's World and gossiping with my co-star's moms, the other part of me thinks. I try and swallow these conflicting parts of me. They're unhelpful and distracting from the issue that needs to be resolved right now, whether or not we're going to church. We haven't been to church in 6 months, our longest stretch ever. I'm concerned about this, but I've brought it up to Mom as much as I can without making things uncomfortable, and she just keeps reassuring me that we'll definitely go back someday when things settle down a bit. I find it strange that we've stopped going to church since my career has taken off and Mom's health has normalized. I tried to broach the subject gently one night when we were driving home from work, but Mom started screaming and saying she was losing control of the steering wheel and that I was causing her tremendous stress that was putting both of us in danger, so I quickly learned to never bring up the subject again. But now, in this moment, as I'm looking down at her sleeping, I'm starting to accept for the first time that our church days may very well be behind us. I guess Michaela was right after all. I used to think going inactive was a terrible thing, a sin to be ashamed of. But maybe it's not. Maybe it's a sign that things are going right. Maybe people go to church because they want things from God, and they keep going while they're wishing and yearning and longing for those things. But then maybe once they get those things, they realize they don't need church anymore. Who needs God when you've got clear mammograms and a series regular role on Nickelodeon? I let her sleep and start memorizing my lines for Monday. I have a stomach ache, I tell Mom as we walk back from Arclight Cafe, where we met with my manager Susan for a quick lunch. Maybe the chicken on the salad was bad, Mom offers of the no blue cheese, no egg, no croutons, no dressing, no bacon Cobb salad, aka grilled chicken and lettuce, that we split for lunch.
Maybe.
We're running down Sunset Boulevard to make it back to set on time. A half hour is hardly enough time for a lunch break, especially if you try to have it outside of set.
Smile for the paparazzi,
Mom orders me. Without even spotting them, a vacant, puppet-like smile crosses my face automatically. My eyes are dead, my soul is nowhere to be found, but a smile is on my face and that's all that counts. Flash, 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 the lights hurt my eyes.
Hi, Glenn,
Mom shouts to a paparazzo like he's her neighbor.
Hi, Deb,
Glenn says as he walks backward while snapping more photos. I'm shocked that Mom doesn't seem aware of how strange this whole interaction is. We approach Nickelodeon Studios and cross into the parking lot. My smile immediately falls off my face. We race into my dressing room so I can change into my wardrobe for the next scene, and I go to the bathroom to take a quick pee beforehand. That's when I see it. Blood. On my underwear. I'm immediately dizzy. I'm not exactly sure what this is, but I think it might be my period. I first learned about a period, sort of, 6 years ago. I was 10, my neighbor Teresa was 10 and 11 months. She never let me forget our 11-month age gap, whether in attitude or explicit reminders.
Do you know what a period is or not? I feel like maybe you don't, since I'm older than you and know more things.
Sure, I said, assuming she meant the period that comes at the end of a sentence.
No, not that period, the other period.
Yeah, I said again, thinking she must have meant a period in time.
Again, not that period, the other period.
I racked my brain to think of what Teresa could possibly mean, then I had it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm satisfied with myself, thinking, duh, a class period, like for high school.
You do?
Teresa was clearly suspicious.
Yeah.
Well, I got mine, and I was scared at first to see the blood, but my mom taught me how to use pads and stuff. Then I went to hometown buffet with all the women in my family to celebrate.
Celebrate what? I asked innocently, as I desperately tried to use context clues to figure out what kind of period Teresa was talking about.
It definitely wasn't a class one. Nobody would celebrate that.
To celebrate becoming one of them. Becoming a woman.
Teresa said it like it was something she'd been wanting her entire life. Like it was some romantic, incredible, alluring thing. Becoming a woman. I was confused. I envied several things in Teresa's life. Her pinball machine, her collection of Barbies, especially the ones with the short hair that Mom would never let me get because she thought it might make me want to cut mine. And yes, even her trip to Hometown Buffet, a restaurant that my family deemed too expensive. But I did not envy her becoming a woman. Becoming a woman was the last thing I wanted. Now as I'm sitting here on the toilet with my blood-spotted underwear at my knees, I'm sure this is it. This is the thing Teresa was talking about.
Mommy? I call out.
Mom asks me what's up, and I swallow how mortified I am so that I can utter my next sentence.
I'm bleeding.
The door bursts open before I even get to the ing and bleeding, and Mom wraps me in a big bear hug while I'm on the toilet.
Oh, sweetie,
she says with the gravity of someone consoling a friend who's just lost their beloved pet.
Oh, sweetie, I am so sorry.
Mom wraps a long strip of toilet paper around her hand and tells me to stuff it in my underwear while she goes to get Patty, my soft-spoken schoolteacher. I watch the clock tick by 10 minutes of slow-burning hell until Mom returns with Patty. Patty whips out of her back pocket a baby pink wrapped square with a little strip of white tape across it. She wags it in front of my face like it's a $100 bill. She beams and pulls me into a warm embrace while Mom runs off to tell the AD why I'm running late.
Congratulations, Jeanette, Patty says softly into my ear. Congratulations on becoming a woman.
I trudge onto our school hallway set, where our next scene is taking place. I can tell by the way the PAs and ADs are treating me that they've all heard the news. I'm humiliated. And ashamed. How did I let this happen? How did I become a woman? I don't know the answer, but I know the solution. I know what I'll do to fix this. Tomorrow there won't be any 2% milk or honeycomb or smart ones. I've been slacking, and the slacking needs to stop. I need to get back to anorexia. I need to be a kid again. Mama, I promise I'll be all right. I'll call to say I love you every night. I'm just trying to write the story of my life. Mom and I are sitting in our room at the Hampton Inn & Suites in downtown Nashville, Tennessee, where we've been living for the past 3 months while I work on my country music career. We're splitting a Nutrisystem frozen lasagna dinner. We ordered the month-long program to keep each other on track, since Nashville has so much more lard than L.A., as Mom says. While listening to the final mix of my first single, Not That Far Away, a song written from my point of view by a couple of songwriters I sat next to for a few hours, to my mother, about being on the road without her and how much I miss her, even though in reality I've never spent more than a few hours away from her in all my 18 years. I don't know much about music, but I know as I listen to this song that I find the rhythm unrhythmic, the melody one note, and the production outdated. I express none of these thoughts because of how much Mom loves it. Tears are streaming down her cheeks. Granted, I don't think they're just tears of joy. There's a weight to them, too, a significance. And I think I know why. Life has imitated art, if you can call this song that. You can't. My music career initially started as a result of the writer's strike of 07, when iCarly was put on indefinite hiatus until things got settled. During that hiatus, Susan suggested I started working with songwriters to put together